Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my new series, Parrish. My character, Gray Parrish, was a getaway driver.
I'm retired from life. You know that.
He's in a world over his head.
Tell me about this driver job.
And he's asked to start to figure things out.
I did what you told me to.
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Well, if dreams come true, I think I'm dreaming. I am sitting in the West Village in New York City on the most glorious, beautiful day. The sun is shining, the air is perfectly crisp, people are out smiling, the streets are bustling, and I'm sitting at my favorite restaurant in the West Village, Via Carota. And if you don't know Via Carota, it's an Italian restaurant on Grove Street. This place is about as classic New York as it gets, with a delicious menu, exposed brick walls, beautiful wooden floors, and some of the best people watching this city has to offer. Seriously, when you come here, if you have the chicken, the cacio e pepe, and the market green salad, you will be in heaven. And it's so hard to get into. I'm telling you, there's always a line, and it's not because it's douchey, it's because it's so good. So today is a super fun day. I'm having lunch with a very good friend, Scarlett Johansson. I mean, get your butt
in here. They're shooting like a TV show next door.
Scarlett's entrance goes surprisingly undetected, partly because of her face mask and understated outfit, and partly because she arrives alone in an Uber without a publicist or assistant in tow.
Bruce Fozzie, you invited me to a restaurant and there's a full movie production happening next door.
Scarlett comes into the private wine tasting room we've taken over in the back of the restaurant with the energy of any New Yorker who's running slightly late. She's rushed, but not stressed.
Scarlett
Johansson, I am sorry. I did not get the city guide.
At first, I thought, are these people all waiting for Bruce Fozzie? Do they know he's inside?
Pull up a chair. We're going to have some fun. I'm Bruce Fozzie, and this is Table for Two.
Every time I pass by a movie set in New York, I get a feeling of both, I'd say, warmth mixed with panic mixed with pity.
That makes sense. It all is, it's almost like you have like post-traumatic stress because of, you know, years of.
Shooting in New York is tough.
Cheers.
Cheers, Bruce Fozzie. Yep. I remember we were shooting Vicky Cristina Barcelona in Barcelona.
Yes.
Seems ideal, right? Everybody's like, oh, you're going to Barcelona for whatever, 2 months or something like that. You're gonna have the best time. It's so beautiful, and the food and the beach. And at the time I was like 20 years old or whatever. I seems like great. This is gonna, it was honestly going to work every day. I felt like I was suiting up for battle because first of all, Woody Allen, I think has reached like God level status in Spain. Somehow he is untouchable there. And so we would have probably, I'm kidding you not, I think probably 600 plus spectators, 600 people.
Wow.
We would be shooting this scene. I would be talking to Rebecca Hall. We're across from each other at, you know, a little cafe in Barcelona and we're lamenting our problems. And then behind Rebecca Hall would be 600 spectators, 50 paparazzi, people talking during the take.
So how do you concentrate?
I don't know. It was a nightmare. Honestly, I have to say, I love my job. I love, you know, I'm not complaining about it. But you know what? Maybe actors are kind of in a weird way sort of gearing up for those moments because you have to just suspend your disbelief and go and like zone out, and we do it all the time. Whatever's going on in your life, whatever's going on in reality, you kind of figure out how to use it or lose it. I remember one time Woody and I were shooting something for this movie that we did called Scoop, and it was the silliest, most goofiest scene. We're at the end of it. Do you know there's an English, like, delicacy, I don't know if you call it a delicacy, but called spotted dick? You know what that is?
No.
I don't know. I think it's, I can't even remember
I
what
it is. I think I've seen a spotted dick.
So, yeah, I don't know what it is. It's like, maybe it's a dessert, it's probably a sausage of some kind. I don't know. It doesn't have to get involved with sausage. Anyway, at the end of the road, he had to say something like, "Well, I've got to be off. Like, it's spotted dick at the hotel tonight," or whatever. And he could not keep, he couldn't keep it together. Couldn't keep it together. First a couple of takes, it was like, okay, it's like giggles, giggles, giggles. And then it was hours of this one take. He was so angry with himself to a point where, like, it was hysteria, where we were both, like, pre-laughing before. It was, the joke wasn't even funny. It was just we were so nervous that it wasn't going to happen. Anyway, we couldn't do it. We had to stop the workday.
Did you have to change the line?
No, the line, he was like, he was so, it was crazy. And then everybody was pissed. This is what the point is.
Right.
Not about the spotted dick, not about Woody Allen, but it's about the fact that these people, you know, your crew, this is just their workday.
Yeah.
And they
right.
have their family, and they got up at 6 a.m.
right.
and they need to get home because their kids have homework and whatever other thing.
Yeah.
And we had to come back the next day and do it. And it was, I've never seen Woody actually that angry. He was so angry at himself. So the tape that's in the movie is really not great. But anyway, point is, respect the crew.
Right.
You got to do the
right.
work. You got to
right.
suck it up.
It's their office. It's their office.
It's their office.
So the menus are in the backs of your
they
chair.
Are. As Scarlett and I move on from Spotted Dick, we order the cacio e pepe and a frittata. I'm going to do a cacio e pepe.
Oh, yeah. We have our tortino di carciofi. It's like a Tuscan-style frittata.
Can I get that without the parmesan?
Very good. Thank you so much.
And dive into the truly unique space that Scarlett occupies in Hollywood. You bring up a point which I didn't even think about. As you have become more and more famous, how would you get a scene done if people were just screaming Scarlett, Scarlett? I mean, we couldn't even take a picture under that carpet screaming your name. This is, you know what I mean?
I'd threaten violence, probably.
How do you find that it's, even in day-to-day life, like walking?
Day-to-day life walking, I'm usually the most unrecognizable person, probably. And I think it's because I'm short.
It's interesting because you, Scarlett, to me, are what I consider to be a bombshell. And I've seen the movies where you, the bombshell-ness of you, you're able to put aside. And of the past, when I think of bombshells like Rita Hayworth, Marilyn Monroe, they seemingly always had that. They couldn't get away from that. How do you sit in that chair so uniquely in Hollywood?
Oh, gosh. You know what, though? There was a period of time, actually, right around the time I met your wonderful husband, Brian Lord. At the time, I had been working for a long time. I started working when I was 8 years old and, you know, kind of had different periods. I worked, you know, I worked in a movie when I was 10 called Manny and Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
So that helped me kind of start getting seen by bigger casting directors and stuff. And then I got cast in The Horse Whisperer, which was a huge deal for me. And then I was able to read for even more established directors and ended up working with the Coen brothers. And I started around that time kind of, I did a movie with the Coen brothers called The Man Who Wasn't There. And around the same time I did Ghost World with Terry Zwigoff. And I kind of became like an ingenue sort of, and I think that's just part of, you know, that young girls like that are really objectified, and that's just a fact,
yeah.
You know? And so I think whatever box they're put into, it sort of sets you on this trajectory for how your life will go. Now, obviously, women are really able more now to choose their own paths. But for me, it was like, okay, I kind of started down this path of ingenue, and then, you know, I did whatever movies, and then I did Lost in Translation and Girl with Pearl Earring. And by that point, I was, you know, 18, 19, and I was coming into my own womanhood and flirting with my own, like, desirability and sexuality. And it was, I think, because of that trajectory that I had been sort of launched towards, I really got stuck in this. And also, it was definitely a part of my management at the time. That was a big part of it, you know, my agency and all that stuff. But I was kind of being groomed in a way to be this, what you call a bombshell type of actor. I was playing the other woman and the object of desire. And, you know, I suddenly found myself cornered in this place, like I couldn't get out of it. And when, right around that time is when I met with Brian. I remember we had lunch. I think it was lunch at Joe Allen in Midtown. But Brian is so calm, and he has such empathy, genuine empathy, and he's so understanding, and he's such a good listener. And it was like I'd met this man, and of course he's very handsome and very, you know, he's very alluring in that way. But he's just, he's such a gentleman, and he really, and he loves movies, and he loves actors, and he loves real work, you know, real great work and art and performance. And he thrives, I think, on putting together great creatives and like making opportunity for people to do compelling work. And he just got it, you know. I mean, it would be easy probably to sit across from someone in that situation and go, this is working, you know.
Yeah.
Because of course, why change it? But I think for that kind of bombshell, you know, that burns bright and quick, and then it's done, and you don't have opportunity beyond that. And I just felt like, how is this burning out so quickly? And it was just an interesting, weird conundrum to be in. But it really came back to doing work, to working at it, and trying to carve a place in different projects and work in great ensembles.
What were some of those projects post that lunch that started, that you sort of said, okay, you turned the corner on the road?
Mm-hmm. So firstly, you know, I got this incredible opportunity to work on the second Iron Man, which that part at the time was very underdeveloped and over-sexualized, but I wanted to form a relationship with Jon Favreau, who I worked with a couple of times after that, who's an inspiration for me, and I also wanted to work with Kevin Feige, who's the head of Marvel, who I knew had like a vision for this big picture, which at the time, people forget, that genre was not what it's now. It was the beginning of that time. We hadn't seen anything. I mean, the first Iron Man with Robert Downey was a sensation. You know, it was unprecedented in many ways. And so I wanted to align myself with it. That was one piece, which turned out to be a very good piece. That was a good bet, right?
Right. It was a very good bet. It was on a lot of levels, but it took you through the next decade of your life.
Yes.
Really.
Right. Definitely. And it was creatively, it turned out rewarding in every way, right? But that was that one piece. And then I did a play in New York called A View from the Bridge, the Arthur Miller play with Liev Schreiber and Michael Christopher and Jessica Hecht. And that was a humongous turning point for me.
Well, you were incredible in that play. You won a Tony for that.
I did.
We went out afterwards. You were wearing a green dress. We went to a karaoke bar on First Avenue in the 50s, like where you used to live.
I remember I stuck my Tony on the counter. Nobody else was there. It turned out to be like a show tunes bar, which was crazy. So all the bartenders had insane voices also.
They did, that's right.
Right? And then we all just brought out our best like Frank Sinatra impression and...
Well, not we all. But
one,
I will tell
one
you,
person.
Scarlett stood up in this gorgeous green dress and you sang it.
spot, Adam, some music. I had no idea you could sing like that, just so you know. And that was quite a choice with you saying, okay, I'm going to do this to achieve the goal to pivot, because you actually walked away with a Tony. You know what I mean? So you have the chops, you know?
I was terrified. I mean, I was so terrified. I had this really interesting moment where, because I thought, oh, God, you know, I'm just going to get ripped apart. Like, I've never played in this playground before, yeah. And people are going to think and say, they're going to come there and they're just going to be hoping that I fail, right. So they, like, you know, can have the, I don't know, whatever satisfaction of that. And I remember just having this feeling, oh my God, everybody wants me to go, everybody wants me to go. And I remember Liam Schreiber said to me, and he said to me, he was like, are you kidding? These people have spent upwards of, you know, whatever many hundreds of dollars, yep, for a seat. They're having a night out in the town. They went to a really nice dinner beforehand, or maybe this is the first time they've ever seen a show and they, you know, scored these tickets last minute or whatever it is. They want you to win.
Yeah.
You know,
they're rooting for you.
Right, they are rooting for you. They want to see a tour de force performance from everybody in this show. And that was such a gift, mm-hmm, that perspective that he gave me. And I've carried that with me. It changed my whole state of mind.
That's amazing. I mean, the gift of a peer with that experience to be able to sort of set you free.
Yes.
And then the winning of the accolade from your peers to say, and you did it.
Welcome back to my conversation with Scarlett Johansson on Table for Two. As we settle into the wood-paneled wine tasting room, an affable waiter occasionally pops in to refill our wine glasses. Our time together carries on, uninterrupted, as we dive further into Scarlett's career.
So, if you had to sort of say the game-changer professional things in your life, I mean, what comes to mind, of course, to me is The Horse Whisperer. You started certainly super early, and you went to play with Ethan Hawke. You were a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
What would the jumps be for you if you had a look at it?
Well, definitely, I mean, getting Manny and Lowe at the time, that was a huge jump for me because it was my first leading role. I was 10. You know, it's interesting because early on when I was auditioning as a child, every single part I got was a big step. At the time when I was a kid, like, there were a few actresses that are still working and have fantastic careers now, like Kirsten Dunst and Natalie Portman and Lily Sobieski at the time. Those were careers that I looked up to as a child actor, and they were all like a few years older than me. And at that time, when you're a kid, it makes a difference, because
yeah,
if you want to cast a 12-year-old, you're not going to cast a 9 or 8-year-old, mm-hmm, right? So when I was younger, there were a lot of small steps that got me to The Horse Whisperer, but that was huge. That was my first, you know, big studio movie. It was a huge part. It was like they auditioned every person.
Beautiful.
It was a beautiful experience.
Your performance is beautiful.
Thank you.
It's shot beautifully. It's...
But more than anything, I figured out what acting was. It started to all make sense to me. And not just to be a natural kid actor or whatever, but what is, like, how do you create a performance? So that was a big one for me. And then I would say Lost in Translation, because it sort of was my transition into my adult career. And I would say, oh gosh, it's so hard. After that, it's like a blur.
Yeah.
Definitely doing View from the Bridge. Of course, the first Avengers. And then after that, it's been a lot of different, you know.
Yeah, no, it's so varied. It just was something that came to mind when I was thinking about your career and thinking about all the movies I've seen you in and how diverse from, I mean, the terrifying but incredible performance of Under the Skin. I mean, that was crazy great. Like a terrifying movie. Like, you know, that performance. I just watched this weekend, because I'd never seen it, The Girl with the Pearl Earring.
Oh,
it's a beautiful movie, an incredible performance. It's a very emotional movie, I think.
So I did Lost in Translation when I was 17. And then I had like a few weeks before I was going to shoot Girl with a Pearl Earring. And I had a really hard time doing Lost in Translation. I was 17, I was far away. You know, I was working with Bill Murray, who was like, I was an enormous fan of, and he was, you know, obviously, he has a very big personality, and he's a, you know, he's sort of a formidable character at times. And I was in this, you know, our characters have this kind of real love for one another, this kind of profound relationship, and that was hard for me to, you know, I struggled with that and for different reasons. But it, when I came to do Girl with a Pearl Earring, it was very disorienting. And so when I came out of it, I was kind of like, felt like I was, it was like this weird fever dream, and I felt very unsteady. And I remember when we started Girl with a Pearl Earring, I think I had my 18th birthday, like a couple weeks into shooting or something like that. I was so young, and I was working with all these amazing English actors. I mean, the cast is really, Colin Firth is in it, and now it's, you know, you look back and you're like, oh my God, there's Eddie Redmayne, there's Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, it has all these actors that were starting their career.
That's who that young guy was, okay.
Right. Yeah, but it was such an incredible experience. The set was so beautiful and beautifully lit by Eduardo Serra, and the moments were so quiet, and everything was so contained in a way that was very, it just felt like it fed me. And you know, I needed that experience after this very disorienting experience that I had, and I think it's reflected in the movie.
It really is. And your performance, you know, there's a lot of your performance is not even in the words. It's in you. It's in your eyes. It's in the actions. It's in what you're doing. So it was, well, that's when I refer to it as being quiet in this beautiful way, because you really emote so much that is not in the, as dialogue, but you understand it. When your character gets the pearl earrings at the end, and the housekeeper or chef of the house brings it to you, and you are sent home, and the wife is all upset, obviously, and there's all this affection between you and the husband, the painter, the man of the house, and you look at the earrings, I didn't know, when you took them, you open it, and then you close them up, your character closes them up, that was, what happened to those earrings?
You want them.
I want them. No. Scarlett knows I love jewelry, but that's, and I do want them. But no. I was like, is she happy? Does she love it? Is she angry?
It's complicated, right?
Yeah.
Life is complicated, isn't it? It's like a gift, but then it feels like a slight, you know, it's like, it's thoughtful, but it's also sort of like, must feel like some, like you're being paid off in a way or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated.
It's complicated. I mean, that's a great answer. It's complicated. It's layered. So much about love and life.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Complicated.
Back to Table for Two. I'm sitting here at Via Carota with my friend Scarlett Johansson, and as usual, our conversation swings between the serious and the not so serious, and yet it always returns to food.
You gotta taste this. If you want to just have a little something.
That looks intense.
No, it's really good. So, you know,
I don't want cacio pepe. I'm not hungry. Mm-hmm. If I knew we were gonna be eating this full meal,
I don't
Bruce
understand. Bozzi. Table for Two with Bruce Bozzi. It's about food, it's about wine, it's about
what?
Us.
What are you talking about us? Why do we have to be bloated and wasting?
Let's talk about food for a second. You know, I grew up in a house where we never saw my dad. He was always in the restaurant, so we never had dinner together. As a family, my mother would cook.
Oh, sure.
Can you kind of just paint the picture of the young siblings kind of in, because you guys grew up in Chelsea.
We grew up in the West Village.
West Village.
And, well, I mean, we moved around a lot before that, but we eventually settled in the West Village when I was like 10, and we lived in a lower middle income housing project. And yeah, we didn't eat out ever because we never had money to. My mom did most of the cooking at home when I was little. And she had her kind of meals on rotation. I think she enjoyed cooking to some extent. My dad really enjoyed cooking. My dad was a really great cook. His first wife was Italian and like made an amazing like Putinesque and all those like delicious sauces. Yeah. Like my dad was great at that. And we all love to eat. Like my family is a foodie family. We, you know, my sister and I both love to cook together. My sister is an excellent cook.
You growing up in New York, I feel like if we were decades apart, but in the same borough, I would have loved you. You would have been, yeah. I would have been your gay best friend.
100%.
What sort of, you know, you went to that children's professional school.
Yes.
Like what was, you know, what would, did your siblings go? Hunter's your twin.
Hunter's my twin. So we grew up in the city. I was born and raised in Manhattan. I was born in Lenox Hill Hospital. I have a twin brother who was born 3 minutes after me.
Yep.
I have two siblings, Adrian and Vanessa. And that was our family growing up.
Right.
My mom subsequently adopted a daughter who's now, I can't believe it, 14 years old. But Fennin, and then my father has a son from his first marriage called Christian, and he's older than I am. But we weren't raised with him. You know, it was the four of us growing up. My two older siblings, both went to Stuyvesant, actually.
Wow, smart.
Yeah, smarty pants. Yeah,
smart pants.
And then I was not as academically gifted.
You can't have it all.
But look at me now.
Look at you now.
I'm half eating this frittata with you. So I went to the professional children's school because I started working when I was 8. And I went to regular public schools up until it became impossible for me because I would go away. Let's say I got a job and I had to leave from October to, you know, December 15th or something. I would leave.
Right.
And then my school, you know, the teachers were like, well, we're not going to make a separate curriculum for you.
Right.
We're just going to fail you for being absent.
Right. You're just getting a loser out on your forehead. Yeah.
Yeah. So And it quickly became clear that I had to go to a school that would accommodate that because otherwise I was like never going to have a normal education. My mom made certain that I always had, you know, you have a teacher on set that's like the on-set tutor and you have to bank certain hours and, you know, it's very regulated now because it wasn't for a long time and it was, you know, leading to like these delinquent kids who like never
able
to, you know, they were really...
uneducated and kind of
they were taken advantage of.
Yeah.
As I reached to refill my glass of wine,
Maddie, I mean,
why not?
Scarlett declines because
I have to audition people after this, so
she, unlike me, doesn't find wine helpful in professional settings.
So I went to professional children's school in 8th grade, and it was a much like drastically smaller school than I've been in. I was a New York City public school kid. I guess it was a big adjustment for me. When I got into the high school, 9th grade, I made some fantastic friends who I'm still good friends with today, who you know most of them, actually, or met most of them. And
yeah, your friend, the thing about Scarlett, what she's referring to is your home base of friends are the girls you grew up with.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really, it's not like they're movie star actresses, they're like real. They're your peeps.
Yeah, they're my peeps, and they're like my, oh God, you know, they're my trusted lifeline.
Do you ever wake up now and look at that whole piece of your life and say, holy shit, look where I am, look what I've achieved?
I don't know. Sometimes I have moments, like little glimpses into it, but it's hard for me to see it all as a whole thing.
You know what? You're also at an age where I'm roughly 20 years older than you. You get to a point of reflection as you get older. I think the beauty of your age is you're just present to it, which makes sense to me. Now that I ask the question, because I'm coming from the point of view of like really kind of looking back in certain decades of my 30s and my 40s and my 20s, when you're in your 30s, you're just in life. You're
very
present.
Every once in a while, I'll have, like, I have that more when I look at my children, where I can't believe I have children, and one of them is big. You know, my daughter Rose is 8 years old. She's third grade. She's becoming, you know, pre-adolescent. She's a little, you know, she's a young girl.
Yeah. You know, you're a very strong woman. You are a very smart woman. You are, have an incredible sense of business, as well as artistry about you. You just do, Scarlett. That you're Rose, who is also young, but I've spent time with her, really clear. She's a self-actualized 8-year-old. That doesn't happen a lot, you know what I mean? Like, she comes in with a point of view. I think your journey thus far, you're gonna impart a lot.
I hope so. I often remind her that I work hard, and she knows it too because she sees it, and I let her know also that I enjoy the work that I do.
That's important.
Which is so important.
Yeah.
For your kids to know I'm not leaving you for this job that's I don't want to go to work. I mean, of course everybody has those days, we all do, right? But
right.
To be say I'm going to work and it's going to be a great day, and then I'm going to miss you.
Wait.
But I'm leaving you for a thing that I love to do. And I think that's an important lesson to teach girls and boys, is to pursue work that is satisfying.
That's a big thing. What do you love about what you do?
I love the technical part of my job, which is probably a hard thing to explain, but I love the nuance of it. And I thrive on working with actors and directors that are sensitive to that, to the small adjustments, and that, like, honing a performance or one, I'm talking about one scene even, one moment, and like really getting in the pocket of that and going, okay, that moved, that, it's like, I can only imagine, it's like if you're a painter and you like make one stroke or you switch one color. I don't know, I'm not a painter at all. I'm not that kind of artistic. But, you know, I can imagine you get those jolts of sort of satisfaction. You're writing a song and you figure out the hook of it or whatever it is. Those little, like, victories, I love.
You know, I once had Don Bacardi, who is now in his late 80s, who was the lover of Christopher Isherwood, who still paints portraits. So it was a gift someone gave me. Brian gave me that. And our whole family, and you've seen them. And you're looking at him do something, and he's painting in the picture, and he's upside down, and it's hours. And he literally will say, and he doesn't speak, and he says, "Do not move." And I literally moved a millimeter. And he said, "You know, move back." And so I'm looking back, you know, over the picture, so it's upside down. I'm thinking to myself, this thing is done. Like, I see it. Okay, you got it. And all of a sudden, he does one last stroke. And I saw it in a completely different way. And I think that's the detail. You know, Woody Allen is retiring. I am an epically huge fan of this man's work. He has romanticized a city that I love, that he loves, that you love. Is there a nugget that he's taught you from a director?
You know, it's funny. He has a very particular way of working, but similarly to how you're, you know, describing Isherwood, it's like he... So he doesn't have a monitor. He never watches any physical monitor. I think maybe a couple of times I've seen him with what we call a clamshell, which is like a little teeny monitor. I don't even know how he could see it because he probably can't. I don't know how well he's seeing. But he never uses a monitor, right? So that's really interesting because he sits there and he listens to the dialogue. And a lot of the time, because he can't see what the camera is seeing, he closes his eyes and he like listens to the musicality of the words, and that's how he knows whether he's got it or not. And then sometimes, you know, he hasn't gotten it because he can't see any of the monitors. So you'll say, "By the way, everything we shot on that scene that was so great, blah, 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 it's all out of focus, so we need to reshoot." Which is the one downside of this very poetic, you know, method or whatever. But I think, you know, it's actually true that these work, I think, it has a rhythm, a musicality to it. If there's a line that's not working, and I will try my hardest to make things that work that are not, but if it's tough,
yeah,
you got to abandon it. But it might not actually be the line that's the problem. That's probably what a writer would say. It's not the line that's the problem. And I'd go, well, as an actor, I'd have to disagree. But, you know, there is a musicality to performance and a pacing, and it comes in, you know, physical movement and the choices you make. When I was younger, my parents showed us really age-inappropriate movies. So crazy, but one of them was Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask.
Yes.
Well, I was watching that as like a six-year-old.
That's, what did you understand from that? I mean, I remember seeing that even older. I was a little stunned. I didn't get the whole thing.
What did I get from it? I don't know. There was like a giant rolling breast.
I know. Are you going to direct? Are you looking?
Smooth transition. Yeah. Bruce Fozzie.
Yes. Thank you. It's my job.
I don't know. I would like to direct. But I love producing. I really love producing.
Okay.
And I love producing other people's stuff, and I think I could have, I always joke with Brian about this, and he's like, you're insane. My ideal job is like a corner office on the Disney lot.
Yes, like a little bungalow.
That's what I want. That's all I want. There.
Oh, so that brings me to this. Cities I associate Scarlett Johansson with are Paris, New York, LA. Does each city get a different Scarlett? Does each city inspire you in a different way?
Yeah, definitely. I absolutely love Paris. I moved there when I was in my like mid to late 20s, and I think it's kind of a sister city to New York in a lot of ways. Like, I love that it's a more laid back pace than New York, but it's like this small city with a huge attitude,
and
I like that people are opinionated there, and that people are like living their lives in a very aggressive kind of way, and they like what they like and they loathe what they loathe, and it's passionate, and the city is so beautiful. I mean, it's such a beautiful, nobody would say that it's, I mean, it's incredible the way the light is, it's the buildings in the afternoon.
It's a magical place.
It's a magical place.
It really is. I hope that you and Colin spend more time this year in California.
I hope I'm there more too. I mean, I'd love to be with both of you guys.
As the outside world filters into our lunch and Scarlett catches sight of the time, I try my best to squeeze in just a minute more the way only a New Yorker could, at the expense of Staten Island.
Did you ever think of all the boroughs you'd fall in love with a guy from Staten Island? I mean, come on.
I had never met a person from Staten Island.
That's what I'm saying.
Other than at the Staten Island Zoo when I was 9.
With all due respect to Staten Island, I know.
I can't believe it. No, I mean, I never met somebody from Staten Island. When Colin and I first, kind of had drinks, and we're like, so we know each other, but hi, where are you from type of thing, and he told me he's from Staten Island. I thought, wait, like, you lived there, like, forever you lived there, or, like, you just spent he is from there, he left, when he left high school, his mom is from Staten Island, his dad's from Jersey, but moved to Staten Island.
And
his
great
parents
people.
Are from Staten Island.
Salt of the earth, but it's like the country to me.
I know,
like,
it's...
Where does it...
But it's so close. It's so close. And it's a whole, like, it has its own microcosm.
You know, it's safe to say, Scarlett Johansson, I really want to thank you today, because it fills my heart with so much love that you've taken the time out of, like, being a mother, of working, you have to go now, audition people, that you came and had lunch and did. And this is what a table for two looks like in the West Village. and we're going to have dinner on Saturday.
I'm so excited for our dinner on Saturday. It's
Saturday.
The first show back of SNL.
It truly is.
So that'll be a real New York night.
Completely. We're going to go, and we're gonna have some fun.
Bruce Bozzi, I have to say, yes. Any opportunity to spend time talking to you is a priority for me. I love you so much. You are such a genuine, feeling person and sensitive person, beautiful soul, and I just love our friendship, and I love like meeting minds with you.
Thank you.
In any way. Over a table for two, for 20, for 2,000. I love you.
I love you, darling.
Scarlett's exit from Via Carota is the opposite of her entrance, this time without a mask. The restaurant falls into a hushed silence as eyes lock on Scarlett as she emerges from the private dining room. After I talk her into a few selfies, Scarlett spots her Uber and it's on with her day. We're both left grinning from ear to ear. Table for Two with Bruce Bozzi is produced by iHeartRadio, 737 Park, and Airmail. Our executive producers are Bruce Bozzi, Jonathan Haas-Dressler, and Nathan King. Table for Two is edited and written by Tina Mullen and researched and written by Bridget Arsenault. Our sound engineers are Emil B. Klein, Paul Bowman, and Alyssa Midcalf. Table for Two's LA production team is Danielle Romo and Lorraine Virez. Our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our talent booking is by Jane Sarkin. Special thanks to Amy Sugarman, Uni Scher, Kevin Uvain, Bobby Bauer, Allison Cantor-Graber, and Jody Williams, Rita Sodi, and the team at Via Carota in Manhattan's West Village. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, ah, yeah. Love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Tenor girl go shopping.
Yeah, baby!
Wait!
Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.